You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Hello, and welcome back to this week's Mysteries and Monsters. This week, we turn our attention to a mystery you can hold in the palm of your hand, the Macintosh Stone. This etched stone was found on the shores of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. On it were strange symbols. Were these an unknown type of Native American writing? A clever hoax? Or evidence of European visitors centuries prior to the accepted narrative? We know that the Vikings made it to Newfoundland, so is it such a stretch to believe that they travelled further south from this settlement? To discuss this enigmatic item is Ron Rademacher, a man with a love of Michigan and a thirst for adventure and mystery. We discuss the Macintosh Stone alongside some other unusual Michigan mysteries, and a big thank you to Ron for his wonderful conversations. As always, you can support the show by signing up for Patreon, by clicking on the show notes for early access, bonus content, and prize draws. We're across all social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and subscribe to the channel on YouTube. Our website is now live, so check it out at mysteriesandmonsters.com. As always, the artwork for the show is by Dean Bestall. The show is produced by Brennan Stoll of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's take a trip to Michigan in the company of Ron Rademacher. On this edition of Mysteries and Monsters, I'm joined by Ron Rademacher, author of 6 books about travelling the back roads of Michigan. Ron is described as an explorer, writer, storyteller, and the man who holds the record for getting lost the most times in these Michigan back roads. Ron, welcome to the show. Delighted for you to join me today, sir.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
So, Ron, this career of yours has certainly taken a few turns over the years. I believe you started out in the fashion industry, and then moved into the arts and crafts sector before you created a love letter to the state of Michigan with your writings and your explorations of the state. How have you sort of traversed this journey to get to this point where we're having this conversation today?
Paul, to be perfectly honest, it was just bad luck all around. I mean, I ride around the back roads of Michigan, getting lost, taking pictures, going camping, and there's not a model in sight.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it's been a great transition. It's been a great transition, and the way that I've been doing this, what I'm doing now, for 20 years, and really, it's been a matter of exploration, and I hear about obscure things and obscure places, and I don't write about famous places in Michigan. There are places like Traverse City or Mackinac Island or some of the fantastic places like Saugatuck. I don't do any work on those because most people can find them. I go looking for out-of-the-way places and unusual objects and things that are either unexplained or one-of-a-kind or so obscure that some people, even the locals, don't know that they exist. And that's how it all came about.
Was it just an interest in finding these places, Ron, and a natural sense of inquiry that pushed you into it, and you just kind of thought, I can turn my hand to this? Or was it a passion that you'd kind of focused on most of your life until you'd got an opportunity to indulge yourself?
I'm going to have to say it was the latter. I've always had a tremendous interest in history, and I've always been a reader of history. I've read all about world history and all my life, and I've always been a traveler. I've been traveling since I was 25, And so I would see things or hear about things that I'd never been taught about in school. And when I finally ended up landing back in Michigan and started traveling the state, it was really, I was encouraged by a couple of people. One person said, you know, you should be writing all this down. You're a writer and you should write this down because nobody even knows that this is here.
Mm.
And another person said, I was doing some storytelling at a show, and a guy came up at the end and he said, you know, you should write a book about all this. And I said, no, I don't want to. I don't want to have to fight with publishers and, you know, working to get, you know, 19 cents for a royalty. And the guy said, no, I'm a publisher. If you can write them down the way you tell them, you're going to do very, very well. And he encouraged me to do, to step beyond myself, to do more than I thought that I could. And now years later, we have 6 books in print. I'm writing another one right now. And the website has hundreds of pages of places to go and things to do in Michigan that are off the beaten path.
I mean, it is a lovely and carefully built site, obviously in preparation for this. And as I would do with any of my potential guests, Ron, I take a dive into what they've done and what they do and have a look. And it's, for me, especially living in the UK, it's always interesting when I speak to people from across the world in different areas. And I love to have a delve into where they live and what's there. Because for people like me, we probably don't know very much about a state such as Michigan, because it's one of those states that I think often gets forgotten in the scheme of things, Ron, because of its position, and there are other places in America that tend to hog the headlines. And so it's always fascinating for me to take a tour of these places and have a look at some of the stunning picturesque locations and local legends and some of the beautiful vistas that these states can offer a tourist such as myself.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And of course, we always invite people from foreign countries like England or Ohio to come and join us so they can see the beautiful stuff we have up here. Because Michigan is a very diverse state. I've had people ask me, well, are you ever going to do this with any other state? And there are only, I've been to all but 4 of the United States. And there are only 2 or 3 that have the diversity of lifestyle and topography and history that this state has. So it was just luck that I ended up starting this project here. And quite frankly, I'll probably never finish Michigan. I'll end up going over to the other side before I get done.
So when you got the opportunity to write your first book then, Ron, what was the subject matter that kind of fired up your creative juices and saw you hit the writing trail?
It was just the places that everywhere I went and I talked to people who, you know, I talked to people all over the state, and I would tell them about, you know, something like the Iago Springs over on the east coast of Michigan, or Negligon State Park, where there's this gigantic ruin the size of a football field that no one even knows is there. And just in talking to people, I decided, you know what, I'm going to write this down. And the first book I wrote is now the Road Trips book. It has about 35 chapters, and it's all just places to go for an hour or for a day. We're going to find something that's remarkable. They're always real. They're always touchable. You can always get right up to it and see it, but you probably never heard of it before. And from that, it's just gone from book to book to book, because people kept saying, well, you should do another one of these. And so I did.
Yeah. And just keep unpicking and delivering these wonderful lost places, because I think the other aspect of your writing is that I would be amazed if people in Michigan don't often know where some of these places are, Ron, or know of these locations, really, because I think often we forget what's right in front of our faces often and tend to cast our eyes further apart.
Well, it's always, I'm not sure about there, but I know that here people know a lot more about something that's 200 miles away than they do about something that's 5 miles away. They'll be living near something that's wonderful. We just never quite got over there to see it. In fact, I did a show at the Boniface Arts Center in Escanaba 2 days ago. It was a 2-hour show. And the people who were Zooming in, because we were doing a lot of it remote, and there were a few people in the audience, some of them said, wait a minute, you're telling me that that's just 15 miles from here? I grew up here. That can't be true. And that's the whole thing. It's a matter of tracking down and recording some of this wonderful history and great places that even the current generation doesn't know anything about, that they're actually there.
I mean, I'm never surprised to hear that, to be fair, Ron, because it's a very similar situation here, because where I live in Sheffield, within 30 minutes drive from where we live, is the historic village known as Eam, which is infamous because it's officially classed as the furthest part of England that the Great Plague of 1665 reached, and the and the villagers took the sacrificial decision to essentially quarantine themselves and basically gave themselves a death sentence, primarily. And yet I would suspect that 90% of the population of the area had no idea it's even there. It's one of those things you learn at school, and I think a lot of people just put it out of their minds. And when you go there, it is incredible, because most of the village is still intact. Most of the houses will have a plaque on it, and it will simply tell you the name of the family that lived there and how many of that family passed away during the plague.
And it's still the so Sheffield. Correct me if I'm wrong. That's northern part of.
Yes. Yeah. Sort of central,
a little bit
north.
South of Hadrian's Wall, though, right?
Yeah. We're about 200 miles down from there.
From the wall.
Yes.
So that. Well, you know, I mean, that's all I got.
Yeah,
I
that's mean, all right.
Up everything, you know, that's all I got on England. But the village is still there.
Yes.
And people can go, and they're exposed to this forgotten history.
Yeah. You can just basically turn up. You don't have to book a tour or anything. You can just wander around the village.
I want to get this straight, though, Paul. I want to get this clear in my mind.
Yep.
The villagers volunteer to quarantine themselves and die out to prevent the disease from spreading.
Yep. I mean, it is one of those stories that when you discover
that's a great story. Those are the kind of stories I look for. I may invent a town here.
Yeah.
to make believe. That's just this was in the 1300s, you said?
17th century, 1665 it happened. 1665. And it was the furthest the great plague that swept through Europe. It was officially the furthest north it got. There were a few minor outbreaks past that, but Derbyshire was as far north as it got from the south of England, so obviously it came up through the trade routes and then via London and obviously went through the country, and it obviously killed thousands and thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah, something like, was it a third or half the population?
Third of the population, near enough. Yeah, it's a remarkable story, and yet I would imagine most people under 40 in this area have no idea it's even there. And it's a beautiful place as well. You know, if you go on a summer's day, it's in the Derbyshire Dales, Peak District. It's absolutely stunning.
Well, I'll give you a similar story here in Michigan. Hmm. In the northern part of Michigan, there was a town, and I'm going to butcher this. This is how we say it here. It was called Piercini, which would be P-E-R-E, Pear, Chenet, but we say it Piercini. And it was a huge lumber town. I mean, one of the most highly populated towns back during the lumbering era here in the 1800s. Hmm. And I believe it was typhus hit.
Yeah.
And in the space of 3 years, it went from 1,500 people to 8.
Oof.
And the entire town was wiped out. And the few remaining people, the 6 or 8 people who survived it, of course, they left. Mm-hmm. But the town was left there. It was just sitting there. Now the buildings are gone because of the climate, but the graveyard is there, the foundations of the town are there, and it was a place that was one of the most thriving towns in all of northern Michigan, and in a space of 3 years, it evaporated.
Wow. That's remarkable. When was that? Was that the 19th century then?
I'm going to say, I'm going to take a wild stab here because I shouldn't have done that because I don't have the facts in front of me. No, but the lumbering era would have been late 1800s.
Mm. Yeah.
When the lumbermen were going through there before they got to the Upper Peninsula, because what they did here is, you know, we cut down all the trees. Mm. We learned that from you guys. You cut them down to build ships.
Yep.
We cut them down to build everything else.
Yeah.
And so it started south and went north, and the lumbermen just cut down everything until they went across the Mackinac Bridge into the Upper Peninsula. The bridge wasn't there. Hmm. But so this would be around 1825 to 1850, somewhere in there is when Piercini evaporated off the map.
Yeah. Remarkable. And the graveyard's still been left there with the bodies and everything.
Yeah, the graveyard is there. Yeah, in fact, there are several of them around. One of them I write about in my work is the Cliff Cemetery, which has been abandoned for 150 years. But if you know where to go and find it, you'll discover that ancestors of the people who are buried there still go there and tend those graves. Mm-hmm. And it's actually located in the middle of a forest. There's no road or anything to it. So Parachini is the same way, and it's one of the most haunted places in the lower peninsula of Michigan. There are constant stories about things happening out there. The story about, you know, people go out to park and maybe have a little fun under the stars, and they wake up and they discover there's handprints all over their car from children, things like that.
Fantastic. Excellent. Love a spooky story on this show, Ron.
I can give you a bunch of spooky stories. It happened to me in the, just so that when you're going through this, I don't get haunted. Mm. They don't like me. And I've stayed in haunted buildings by myself. Where I live is an inn that is haunted. I've stayed in other inns around Michigan where I've been the only person in the building. I don't even get a simple knock, anything. But about a month or two ago, I was going to be on a show similar to this, and they wanted to really focus on the paranormal section of things. And in my bathroom, a handprint appeared on the wall one day before the show. And so I brought some of the people who live, you know, who work around here, and I said, have you ever seen this? They said, oh, yeah, that's Nell. Every now and then, if she's interested, she'll show up and she'll leave a handprint. And I have a picture of it. Yeah. You can't wash this handprint off. So there's something.
Ah.
Yeah, I'm a skeptic when it comes to that stuff, but there's something here.
Absolutely. Clearly, that was Nell giving you the seal of approval for the conversation.
She said, bring it and don't misspell my name.
I mean, Michigan seems a state full of mystery and intrigue, Ron. And obviously, one of the key topics I want to discuss with you is the Macintosh Stone. So, for anybody who's not aware of this, Ron, how on earth did this object come under your radar? And how did you get involved in this peculiar item that was discovered?
Well, let me tell you first where and when it was found.
Mm-hmm.
This was found, I don't know how familiar your listeners are with Michigan and our geography here, but the Upper Peninsula of Michigan is far north, and Lake Superior separates it from Canada. That's how far north it is. And there's a place called the Keweenaw Peninsula, which has been a copper and iron mining site since prehistoric times.
Hmm.
On the tip of that peninsula, which juts way out into Lake Superior, a guy by the name of Charlie McIntosh, who's a lumberman. He goes out and marks trees and manages forests to keep things sustainable and clean things out. He was out, and when he's waiting for other people to show up, he goes and he picks what we call agates. Mm. Agates, A-G-A-T-E-S. They're gemstones.
Yeah.
And you pick them off the ground, and then you polish them up, and they make semi-precious gemstones.
Mm.
So he was doing that one day, and then he would just throw them into a bag, and he would bring them home, and he would throw them into his garage. Well, one day he went to start polishing stones, and he discovered one that he had picked up because he had marked the bags, and he saw that there were carvings on it. And that is how the Macintosh Stone was found. It was 50 feet above the current level of the water at that time, which would be 1980, and it is covered on both sides with very intricate carvings. I found out about it. Again, this is just by accident. You know, for anybody who doesn't believe in serendipity in the spiritual world, just listen to this. I'd been driving by in my travels and my writing. I've been driving on US 2, and I've been driving by a sign that said NEMA Inn, 5 miles, for years. One day I decided to drive down there and went to the NEMA Inn, and Charlie McIntosh and his wife Lori had just bought the place a week earlier. And we got talking, and I said to him, I said, your name is McIntosh. I said, look at this little booklet I have here. You know anything about this Macintosh stone thing? And he said, yeah, that's mine. I literally drove right, and I said, really? I said, can I see it? He said, sure. And so he brought this thing out, and this is going to be 10 years ago when this happened. And from there, I began to track down what this was and what the carvings on it represent. I've presented a couple of times to the Ancient Artifact Preservation Society, and it was literally, Paul, just a sheer... I decided to turn and go down a road I hadn't been down for years, and I'd been driving by it for years. And on that day, he happened to be there, and I happened to be looking for someone who knew about the copper culture and the Macintosh stone. It doesn't get any weirder than that, man.
No. I mean, you were very kind to send me some beautiful pictures of the item, this stone. It is very unusual. I mean, it would be... I suppose some people would probably have tried to dismiss it for numerous things, Ron, but clearly someone took the time and the care to carve this stone with some very intricate designs. And what I found very interesting about this story is that obviously when it was first discovered and when you first saw it, I think the interpretations of the designs were... I think one side's got a sort of crescent moon emblem on it, whilst the other side seems to have some kind of symbol that looks similar to a spider. And yet, that doesn't seem to be the interpretation now, does it?
Not at all. The whole thing was just so difficult to figure out. You know, first of all, it's very small. This object is the size of about two American 10-cent pieces.
Yeah.
Very small, and it's almond-shaped, and it's very, very old. The carvings are very worn, so if you look at it with just the naked eye, it's difficult to see anything. But I had looked at it from a book called Coming for Copper, and in that book, it's displayed vertically. It's standing on end, and so for years, I thought... that's how you were supposed to look at it. Then I started looking at it on its side, but we thought, oh yeah, this is a crescent moon here, and this over here, this is obviously a spider, big fat legs on each side. And I had sent pictures all over to historical societies and people who interpret these things, and they were thinking, yep, this is Native American, or you know, because this is a bird and this is a spider, really don't know anything else. And all of that turned out to be entirely wrong, because one day I was sitting at the Namah Inn and I was whining, believe it or not, I'd just been to the Ancient Artifact Preservation Society meeting. No one there could figure it out. Some very, very well-known people in this field took a glance at it and said, nah, these are natural markings. And some people at this inn said, well, let's take a look. And a lady was looking at the side of the stone that we thought was the spider side. And she said, well, can you flip that over? And I said, what, you want to see the other side of the stone? And she said, no, I want to see, flip it 180 degrees. And then she said, well, that's a man's head right there. Now, this is after having been working on the stone for years. I mean, I'm not trained in this. I was just the only one who was bulldogging it. And as soon as we flipped it over, everyone in the room said, oh, my God, that's a man. And then we realized that the spider was not a spider, but it was actually another man sitting on what appears to be a throne with his hands before his face in an attitude of benediction or blessing. And from there, the whole thing opened up into a completely different interpretation of something that had been enigmatic at best before that.
So, in regards to other artifacts, Ron, has anything similar been discovered in the area? Is there any kind of clue as to who brought it there or where it came from? Because the designs and the way it's been inscribed, in my very basic interpretation, it looks European in that kind of regard, which would then suggest it's probably come over post-Columbus. So I would imagine, has it been one of those items where different factions have tried to claim it for different sections of history?
That's a great question. No, so far no one has actually tried to claim it. Everybody's trying to stay as far away from it as possible for some reason. I got the same problem. But for several years, we had thought that this might be a Phoenician prayer stone or that it was ancient prehistoric American. But when we discovered that there were men on one side, and there are three men on the main side of this, and then when we discovered that the other side actually has a two-hulled ship rather than a crescent moon, I began to do some research, and I'm completely convinced that this object is European, Northern European, certainly. And I think that it was either a commemorative piece carved to commemorate a voyage of discovery, or it is a talisman of power, power being the power to purchase. This is a credit card.
Yeah.
I think that these people were preparing for a great voyage, and you could take this and you could rent ships and you could hire men and purchase supplies, and this represented that this your activities were backed by the prince or the bishop that was behind this voyage. Because at that time, this has been dated variously from 1000 AD to 700 AD. And at those periods of time, most people were illiterate.
Yeah.
And so everything was done with symbolism. And so the symbols, you know, that you could communicate with everybody. You could show them this picture and they knew that was a pub. That you'd know that, Paul, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. So my current position on this is that it is not Mediterranean, which we thought for a long time, and it's not Native American. I think that this object was part of a voyage to come to the New World, whether it was 1000 AD or 1600 AD. The questions that jump up here are, one, it was found on the Keweenaw Peninsula, and we know that. We know exactly where this was found, and we know when. And it's still in existence. I have it in my possession. So this is not something that's been lost. If anybody wants to see it, they can come here, and I'll show it to them. So we know all of that, but what we don't know is the people who lost it, what were they doing on the Keweenaw Peninsula jutting out into Lake Superior? What were they doing there? I mean, they were there on a pleasure excursion. This is a wild country now. It is very, very difficult to get there even now. So we don't know that, and we also don't know what kind of a tool was employed and what craftsman was employed, because these are, you've seen the pictures, these are very intricate carvings. And this was not just done, you know, like you took your wood carving set when you were wood-burning, you know, kid, and as a little kid. So it's an object of some great value, but I think it's European. Beyond that, there are some things that make me think that it has to do with the who are those knights you guys had over there?
The Templars.
Those are the guys. There's some evidence that it may have had to do with that. Beyond that, it's still a mystery.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of those situations as well, because as someone, as you referred to at the beginning of our conversation, Ron, I've always had a thirst for historical knowledge and reading about past civilizations, and especially in Europe, we've had numerous great empires rise and fall over the last two millennia, from the Greeks to the Romans, to the Huns, the Scandinavians, the Gauls. And I think as our knowledge of North America and the voyages of discovery continue to be expanded upon, it is very interesting where we are now in regards to how people view who arrived first from Europe. And the more we go forwards in time, it seems that a lot of people are now coming round to the interpretation that if anybody landed there, it was probably the Vikings who were the first to turn up, which would guide us towards some part of the Scandinavian nations being the previous owner of this particular item, Ron. Have you been able to sort of gauge the designs on it and try and find a sort of historical comparable image in regards to that? And if so, whereabouts do you think that's leading you towards?
Well, the of course, this goes back to the question of was there from our point of view over here, and for strictly ridiculous reasons, it's been, you know, put forth that prior to Columbus getting here, no Europeans had ever been here, and so this was an unexplored continent, and hence we had manifest destiny. But there's a lot of evidence that people came here way before.
Yeah,
and there's I'll give you two examples of other evidence that Europeans got to the Americas way before 1000. And I just want to point out, I want to give you an interesting measurement too, because a lot of people say, well, they couldn't have done it. They couldn't navigate, you know, across the Atlantic. I'll just give you a quick lesson here. From the bulge of Africa, that points to the west, to the bulge of Brazil that points to the east, that distance is shorter than the distance from one end of the Mediterranean Sea to the other. So the fact, and, you know, people have been messing about, punting about in the Mediterranean Sea forever. And also the Gulf Stream runs that way. So if you throw a cork into the water off the bulge of Africa, it'll end up in Brazil in about 65 days. I mean, the currents go that way. So it was certainly within, technologically, it was possible. So in researching some of the symbolism on this stone, I ran across two things. One was in a book called The Bronze Age America by Dr. Barry Fowle, and I'd read the book a million times, and I was flipping through it, and came across an image that I'd seen many times, but I'd never connected before, and it simply shows a double-hulled ship with symbols for a lot of men in it, and then it has what looks like a figure eight, and next to it, an oval, which appears on the Macintosh stone on the side where the ship is. And that drawing that's in that book, that is a drawing that's from a petroglyph from Scandinavia from the 1300s. And it's been interpreted as meaning to be thrust upon the waters as in a great voyage.
Yeah.
So if we combine that with these men taking a blessing on the other side, there's evidence that this stone is a commemorative stone or a blessing stone or a stone, a MasterCard for a great voyage. The one that really got me, though, because one coincidence is just a coincidence, but two of them is something completely different. And in Massachusetts, there's a town called Westford. And there's a stone there that has a carving on it that has been a matter of great controversy for as long as I can remember. And some people say that the carving on this stone represents a commemoration for when, I believe, what was the guy's name? St. Clair? Actually visited the Americas. And you know, the etchings show this is what it looks like, and this is the sword, and this is the shield, and this is the knight. And so some people have said, you know, it couldn't possibly be that this is who this is, because Henry Sinclair, that's who this was. And he came here as part of the Templars. Well, I saw this sketch come up on the television, and I didn't know anything about this knight because it's in Massachusetts, and I think about Michigan. But on his shield is the same double-hulled ship and the buckla, the symbol of a figure eight with a circle next to it. It's on his shield, and that's from the 1300s. So with those two and the same symbols appearing on the Macintosh stone, which on the other side shows knights preparing for a voyage, I currently think that this was part of a voyage that came here to be engaged in commerce and trade, and could very well have had something to do with the copper trade that had been ongoing in the Great Lakes region that supplied the copper for the Bronze Age in Europe.
I'm often perplexed when we start to talk about Scandinavian travellers, Ron, and if they did reach the Americas, because they were in Greenland in 1000 AD, which I appreciate is not that close to North America, but it's not much farther away from Europe than it is from America. So I'm often perplexed when people just dismiss the possibility that anybody could have got to North America that early, when we know that the Vikings sailed 3,000 miles across the sea to get to Greenland and settle it until they got fed up with the weather, which is saying something when you live in Scandinavia. To be fair, if you're sick of ice and snow in a country and you're from Scandinavia, that tells you how bad the weather actually is there. So I'm often perplexed when it's just sort of dismissed out of hand, Ron, because the other aspect of all this is, yes, I appreciate this stone was found on the shores of Lake Superior, but you can reach Lake Superior from the Atlantic, I believe, is it the St. Lawrence Seaway that connects it?
Absolutely, sure.
So if the Vikings had the technology and the wherewithal to get to Greenland, which, like I say, is a hell of a journey anyway, and they build a community there, I don't think it's much of a stretch to think, well, if they went that far, surely the thirst for knowledge would be, well, I wonder what's over there then. If we've got here, I wonder what's over there, because surely they would want to keep going. I think that's probably how they ended up in Greenland in the first place.
Well, I would appreciate it if you don't call me Shirley. But yeah, and look, the whole thing about where did the Vikings go and how far did they get has been put to rest. There's a site called Lons All Meadows in Nova Scotia.
Yeah,
it has been proven that is a Viking settlement that was established sometime around 1000 AD.
Yeah.
So we know that they got there. And of course, there's the Vinland map and there's the Norse sagas.
Yeah.
Which tell about these great voyages they took. And, you know, actually, if you go from Scotland over to the New Hebrides and across to, let's see, I can't get it quite right, but across to Iceland, across to Greenland,
yeah,
you're never out of sight of land for more than 2 days.
Yeah.
I mean, these are relatively simple journeys, and Viking longships were certainly built and capable of, I mean, if they could get from the continent over to England to sail up your rivers and get after those monks.
Yeah.
That they could do it.
Yeah.
So, what we have, going back to the McIntosh stone for a second, the frustrating part about this is I've shown this to a lot of people. I've talked about it to a lot of people. And for the most part, it doesn't fit into a narrative. And so it's simply dismissed. But there are people who are very interested in this kind of evidence. And there's one thing that can't be taken away. This thing actually exists.
Yeah.
And it's not a fake. And it's been tested. And we know how old it is. And somehow it got there. And someone had to bring it there and drop it. And to the best of my knowledge, Native Americans were not carving these kinds of images on stones.
I mean, even if you want to look at the possibility that it was dropped there by a Native American tribes person, Ron, which tribes lived in the area? You know, if there was any potential sort of trading going on with any sort of visitors from a faraway land, who were the tribes that inhabited that area at that period?
Well, in that area was primarily the Ojibwe, and they're still here.
Mm-hmm.
I have a photograph of a prehistoric canoe that's almost 40 feet long, made out of one log, which could have easily have transported copper from the Keweenaw Peninsula down to and in one portage could be on the Mississippi River, which would take you all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. These people had been living here for centuries when the first traders showed, and these traders were looking for land. They were looking for wealth. And in fact, I don't know if you're familiar with the Kensington Runestone. It's found in, I believe, Minnesota, which is just a couple of hundred miles west of here.
Yeah.
So these tribes had been trading with and guiding explorers for, I mean, ever since any kind of recorded history. So they were here, and they've still been here, and the tools that they had for getting around this wilderness, which is what it was, and living in it, would have been invaluable to explorers who are literally living by their wits.
Yeah, because I think one of the things that people, especially if they don't live in the northern US and Canada, Ron, is that I think people don't realise just how dangerous the Great Lakes are. They are essentially inland seas, and obviously as a lover of mysteries and weird things, there are countless strange disappearances and weird things that have happened across all of them. And I think for anybody in that period of time, it would have felt like a completely alien environment, because I think it's remarkable just how dangerous those areas are. So you would need the help of anybody local to even just survive, I suspect.
Oh, I agree 100%. You would not be able to. It's not so much the danger from hostile inhabitants or from bears, which we have lots of bears, from wildcats or bobcats. Exposure alone will bring you down in just a few days. And I mean, I go tramping through these forests in the Upper Peninsula all the time, and what always amazes me is how rough and tough this country is, and how you could possibly survive if you had sailed over from Greenland to Nova Scotia and then found your way down into the St. Lawrence Seaway and made your way into the Great Lakes and decided to land and walk across this.
Yeah,
I mean, there are people still get lost in some of the national forests here. Mm-hmm. There's a swamp here that is so vast that you have to drive across it. Now you can't walk across it. Somehow people built railroads across it. And where the McIntosh stone was found is 200 miles west of that swamp.
Yeah.
I mean, these were intrepid explorers.
Yeah. I mean, that is probably one of the things, because as we say, and as you refer to the site in Nova Scotia, the Vikings were thirsty for exploration. I mean, they travelled everywhere, and as you touched on, you know, they raided the UK and Europe for centuries, you know, even sailing up the Thames on their longships. So they weren't,
exactly,
you know,
yeah,
they weren't afraid of anything, and they would raid monasteries to take their gold and all sorts, you know, be in the north of England all the way down to the south coast and Norfolk and Essex and places like that, Ron. So for me, I'm often frustrated that it just seems to be one of those parts of history that some people just don't want to sort of expand upon. In regards to the McIntosh stone, so when did you get it in your possession then from Charlie? Was it a purchase, or did Charlie pass it on and sort of say, can you try and get to the bottom of whatever this is?
Well, good question. Actually, the inn that I live in is the Nama Inn, and Charlie owns this inn.
Ah.
I managed to move here a couple of years ago. I've been trying to move to this part of the state for a long time, but it was so wild that I couldn't do it because I didn't have Wi-Fi and I didn't have cell. Now it's all been solved. So Charlie's here, and he keeps the stone in his possession, although I have it in my possession as we're speaking, because I had it in a show a couple of nights ago. But I always make sure that Charlie keeps it. He entrusts it to me because I'm the only person who has just chased it and chased it and chased it. In my belief, to go back to a point you made a moment ago about the Vikings, but I think that they were actually following sailing and exploratory routes that had traveled hundreds of years before they rose to power. I honestly believe that the Phoenicians had been here, and you know, the Carthaginians may have been here. There's evidence all up and down the east coast of these visitations. So why people still resist this idea, I don't know, because the carvings are here and the actual evidence is here. You know, some things are probably faked. That happens.
Yeah,
human,
yeah,
nature.
Course.
But this is not. And so since Laszlo Meadows has been verified, people's minds are much more open to the fact that there were Europeans roaming around and Mediterranean people roaming around this hemisphere way before Columbus ever got here.
Yeah. I think it is one of those things that it seems to be an inconvenient truth for some historians, Ron, that they just don't want to accept it. And I think the only way that they ever will is if somebody finds the remnants of a longship or something that is irrebutable truth that simply cannot be be denied by sort of allegations of fraud or hoaxing, which has happened, as you refer to. I mean, there is a famous site where someone claimed that they discovered runestones that proved that it was a Viking settlement and perpetuated the myth until it was shown that they had been created with modern tools, which kind of caused a whole stink anyway, because that was one of those hoaxes that fooled a lot of people. And I think when you come to items such as the Macintosh stone and other such items that have been found all over, people are very wary these days that they get caught, despite the fact that, you know, as you refer to, the stone has been dated and proven to be of such an age.
Well, yeah, so I agree with all the things you just said. I want to touch on the lack of a longboat being discovered, because that's one of the big problems that has reared its head as far as the copper culture in Lake Superior. That there are copper mines on Isle Royale and on the Keweenaw Peninsula that date from 1800 BC. And all up to 1250 AD. And there are thousands of these. And it's estimated that 500,000 tons of pure copper were taken out of these mines. And the copper in this area has a very specific DNA. It's 99.9% pure, which means you don't have to smelt it.
Yeah.
You can just pick it up and start working it. And the problem is that this 500,000 tons does not appear anywhere in the North American archaeological record. It's like it just disappeared. It's gone. So people were saying, well, you know, the Phoenicians were coming to get it. And they sailed their ships over and they went down to the St. Lawrence Seaway and up into Lake Superior, and they went to Isle Royale and they loaded them up. And they so here's the problems with that, and I'm going to solve the problem for you guys. There have been no shipwrecks found there. And no shipwrecks anywhere in the Great Lakes of these types of ocean-going vessels. And the reason they've not been found is because they were never there.
Yeah.
The way this copper mining was done is as follows. Native Americans in their canoes could paddle out to Isle Royale and on the Keweenaw Peninsula. And these, I've done the math, I can send it to you if you'd like. One of these canoes, which I described earlier, 40 feet long, could handle a ton of copper and three paddlers with no problem whatsoever. And to go from Isle Royale to the Keweenaw Peninsula and offload that copper is a trip of 10 hours. So three men could do it easily for about 60 days. Now, if you had 100 of those canoes, that's 100 a day.
Yeah.
Far easier than that. But they would do it that way because you could go down the Keweenaw Peninsula and in one portage you could be on the Mississippi River and get all this copper down to Poverty Point, where there were huge smelting works, and into the Gulf of Mexico. The other way to do it was to go 15 miles instead of 50. Go 15 miles north to Canada, offload your copper there, turn your canoe around, go back for another load, and then that copper could either be moved to Wisconsin, to the Mississippi River, or overland to Nova Scotia and the St. Lawrence Seaway, to that area, and unloaded on the ships that were designed for ocean travel. The reason you never found a longboat anywhere in St. Lawrence Seaway or in the Great Lakes around where all this copper was mined, because they were never there. Why would you do it? When you've got a series of, you got canoes and other conveyances that can move the copper from the mine to where your seagoing ships are. Let me just turn this around. When you would come over for beaver pelts, and to take back to England to make beaver hats, you know, the top hats. Well, you didn't sail the doggone ship over into Lake Superior. The trappers brought the pelts to the coast, and the brokers sold them, and you loaded them on the ships, and they sailed back. The ships just went across the ocean. Yeah. Other boats went up and down the rivers. So, I have a photograph of one of these canoes, which is on display here, which could easily have handled this, and it was made from one white pine log, and there's no reason to believe that hundreds of these boats couldn't have been being used. So you move it for 60 days, and then that part is over because it turns to winter up here. And then the miners all go home, and they're with their wives and children. And then when spring comes, they go back out to where the mines are, set up their teepees, and they mine. So that's, they didn't have to have permanent dwellings.
Yeah.
They just used the movable dwellings they'd been using for thousands of years in their other activities.
Yeah. Which, if you know the area and you know how harsh it is, as you touched on, Ron, during the winter months, that seems like a perfectly reasonable situation to work with, because that just makes everything a lot easier for everybody, because nobody's risking their lives trying to navigate ships into that area. And I would imagine in winter the situation would be that some of those ships would be crushed with the ice packs that may occur, because we've all seen the famous footage of what are known as the ice tsunamis that can occur on the Great Lakes. It would be a suicide mission to try and do anything like that over the winter months.
Without question. And just in modern times, everyone's heard of the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Yes.
This happened in November. It wasn't even winter yet.
Mm.
And there are the Great Lakes and Lake Superior especially are known as a graveyard of shipping. Yeah. And yet not a single European longboat ocean-going vessel has ever been found, in spite of the fact that all this activity was supposedly going on. Well, the reason is because they were smart enough to leave those ships out there on the ocean. And you'd moor them in a harbor and move everything back and forth across land. There's no reason to take a three-master and try and sail it into the Great Lakes, because they are just too dangerous.
Mm.
And the ship was not designed for that in the first place. People are smart.
Yeah. So in regards to the missing copper then, Ron, what's the excuse given for its disappearance then? Because as you say, 500,000 tons has been mined. Where's it all gone?
Well, just wonderful question. Of course, there are lots of differing opinions on that. But we do know when it ended. Let's talk about when the mining stopped.
Mm.
The mining stopped in 1250 A.D., very, very suddenly. And around these mining areas, there were slabs of copper weighing tons that were sitting on cradles of oak at the bottom of these shafts that were getting ready to be lifted out. And they were just abandoned there. And there are rock hammers in the tens of thousands that were just abandoned. And we know the date, because while you cannot carbon date copper or any other kind of stone, you can carbon date the oak cradle that it was sitting on.
Mm.
And so they were able to identify exactly when this tree was cut down to build this cradle. So all of a sudden, the copper mining in the Great Lakes stopped, which had been going on for well over 1,000 years. And the reason that it stopped is because the demand for copper fell dramatically, because someone in Europe or on the Mediterranean or in Africa or Asia figured out how to make iron weapons instead of bronze.
Mm.
You no longer needed copper to combine with tin to make bronze.
Hmm.
So the tin was coming from Cornwall, that area.
Yep.
The copper, some people said it came from Cyprus to make the bronze. But the Cypriot copper, there is not enough of it, and has a completely different chemical combination than the copper from the Great Lakes. And so that's where they say the people were coming to get this copper to bring it back to make bronze for weapons. And you can look back in the historical record and you can find as far back as the pharaohs ordering enough armor and weapons for an army of 100,000. Well, where did the metals come from? What we're saying is that it came from these copper mines, and then up through Spain, up the coast of England, that's where the tin mines were, and they could bring it together. And all you had to do then was put those two together, because the copper was so pure, you didn't have to smelt the impurities out.
Yeah.
That's the specific DNA of the copper that comes from the Great Lakes. So the demand came from the Bronze Age. And when the Bronze Age ended, because people figured out how to make even better weapons with which to slaughter one another out of iron, you didn't need bronze anymore.
Mm.
And the demand for copper stopped all of a sudden. The ships stopped coming, so the miners stopped mining.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the theory.
I mean, I find that remarkable, because it's almost as if it happened overnight then, Ron. It's as if everybody just down tools and went, well, that's it, it's done, it's over. Because that's just remarkable that you've still got the cradles.
That's the evidence that's actually there. Just to interrupt you for a moment, on Isle Royal, there are over 5,000 mining pits between 10 and 30 feet deep. And on the Keweenaw Peninsula, there are thousands more. And literally, what you just said is what happened. Everybody just downed tools and said, all right, time for lunch. And never came back because no one wanted this metal anymore. And it wasn't until the American Civil War that there was enough need for copper that this was all rediscovered. And many of the most productive copper mines that have been created since 1800 have been sited on these prehistoric mines that have been there for thousands of years and have just simply been abandoned.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. I mean, coupled with the missing copper. I mean, I'm one of those people, and I just wouldn't accept the, oh, well, we're not sure where it's gone answer, because that just doesn't make sense, because clearly Native American culture does not have a tradition of using copper either, does it? There doesn't seem to be, as far as I'm aware, I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, but they don't seem to have any kind of copper-based artifacts or used it in such a way, did they?
I would love to correct you if you're wrong. But you're not.
well, thank you.
they didn't. And that was what I was saying when I said that it doesn't appear anywhere in the North American, not just the United States, but all North American, into Canada, the archaeological record. Here's how the sequence of events goes. The mines are there. The holes are there. Everybody knows it. I have maps that were done back in the 1800s that show where all these mines were. You can still go to Isle Royal, which is a uninhabited national park in Lake Superior, and you can go out and see these mines. The holes in the ground are there. The tools that were being used are there piled. I mean, in one location, it took 10 railroad cars of just iron stone hammers out of that one site. All that's still laying there. There are huge chunks of copper laying there that had been cut out of the vein that's just below ground that were abandoned. Everybody just down tools and said, okay, job's over. And yet the copper they had already gotten can't be found anywhere, but you can find traces of it all the way down the Mississippi River. You can find traces of it all along the coast in the Gulf of Mexico, which is the route you would then take to make your way to the Mediterranean, following the Gulf Stream once again as it turns north and east outside of Florida. So the evidence is all there, but there are still people who say, well, none of this could be true. I think the McIntosh stone is one of these items that you can't just say, well, it's been lost, it's not real, because we have it. It still exists. And the high-res pictures I sent to you, I had them taken a couple of years ago.
So what's next for the McIntosh stone? Where is this leading us, Ron? Because clearly there are two camps here, I would presume, that there are those that say the McIntosh stone is simply the tip of the iceberg. This could open up a whole new realm of American history, and I would imagine there are others that just poo-poo it and say, oh, well, somebody dropped it on the beach, and that's it.
Your analysis is exactly correct. There's a school of thought that this is these markings are just natural markings from this stone rolling around on the beach. Scott Walter from America on Earth actually told me that. He said, no, this is nothing. But I don't think he took a good look at it. The other side is now what we have to find, if it's possible, is two or three other objects that are from the same time period, that depict the same kind of activity. And, you know, one thing can be an anomaly, two can be a coincidence, but when you get three or more, then you start to have, well, wait a minute, we have to change the narrative. So what's going on with the McIntosh stone is I'm on the air all over talking about it. Shows like yours are letting me talk about it in Europe, and hopefully people will look at this and they'll say, well, wait a minute, my granddad told me about that. That's the real thing is hearing from people who've seen things like this before. That's where it is right now.
I mean, it is for me. I think one of the frustrations I have when it comes to certain aspects of American archaeology is that there seems to be a real cutoff point, Ron, where people just go, there's no point going back any further than this, because I'm mystified why there is not more knowledge about where the native tribes came from. And if they came from somewhere, who was there before them? Because I know there is there are several schools of thought in regards to who the Native Americans were not the original inhabitants of the Americas either. There are petroglyphs that go back thousands of years. So there's clearly a large aspect of culture that I think is still, even in this modern era, being overlooked. And I can't tell you the reason for it. Do you know why it seems that people aren't interested in finding out?
I can't say for certain that I know. I'll give you a theory, and this leads to two other avenues that you and I can explore at some time. One is the mound builders, and when settlers were crossing this land for the first time, they were encountering huge ruins of mound built cities. Cahokia in Illinois is the most famous. If you read the diaries of Lewis and Clark, they talk about getting off the river and looking at a mound field that covered 200 acres. You know, that is now, you know, all of this was lost to the plow, but because, you know, agriculture. But there's a lot of evidence that those things were still there, but it was one of the things that always comes back is, as we were taking these lands, which we took these lands as the people before them had taken them, and the people before the Native Americans had taken them from the people who took them from them, you know, we were justifying it that you know, these were just savages, so we could just take it. Whereas there were very high-level civilizations here. So one thing that happens in the United States, I'm sure it doesn't happen in Britain, but it happens here, is that establishment archaeologists simply will not touch these theories, because it goes against the, you know, what is accepted. And if they get into this, they can lose their tenure, they can lose their accreditation, and they'll never get published again. There is that side of it. The other side of it is that there are dozens of actual, we have two things that happen here. We have artifacts that are found and purported as representing evidence of these ancient civilizations that were here, and those artifacts are lost somehow, and so they're called into question as hoaxes. We have other artifacts that are not lost. Now, the Macintosh Stone is one. There's another artifact that we haven't even published any information on yet that was found recently in Michigan, which is at the very least is enigmatic and actually points back to Egypt. And it was found in a forest here. I was just talking to the guy before you and I got on the air about doing some work on that. I have photographs of it. And, you know, it's so some of these pieces that have been found and not hidden away in the basements of museums because they wanted to hide it for whatever reason are coming to light today. It's a lot better. People are a lot more open, but people still want to see evidence. You know, they don't want to. I was at a conference and a woman was talking about this copper plate that had been found, and she showed pictures of it and all these carvings on it. And when she was done, she took questions and someone said, well, where is it now? And she said, oh, it's been lost. Well, as soon as you say it's been lost, then no one's interested anymore, because so many of those things turn out to be hoaxes anyway. So that's the big thing, is, you know, getting people to look at something like the Macintosh Stone. And I tell people all the time, listen, come here, go to my website. My phone number and email are on my website. Call me. I'll show it to you. Then you can decide.
Yeah. I mean, it is perplexing, because even in a country as small as the United Kingdom is, in comparison with many American states, Ron, we're still uncovering stone circles, petroglyphs, ancient artifacts that you would expect to have been uncovered by now. Because, as I say, one of the arrogant presumptions of modern life is that we've been everywhere. We've discovered everything there is to discover. There is nothing else left to find. And yet, even in a, like I say, in a country as small as Great Britain or the United Kingdom is, we still uncover things on a regular basis, be it lost. I mean, somebody the other week was weeding their garden, doing some gardening, and they found a cache of gold coins from 500 years ago.
I saw that on the news. They were out there digging around in the garden.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Just do it, tidying up, and they find. And this happens quite a lot. And metal detectors will often go into farmers' fields and find gold coins. And I'm sure anybody that's seen anything Josh Gates has done, Josh Gates tends to find sites where things get uncovered which turn history on their head. And he's made numerous visits to the United Kingdom looking for such things, especially in regards to the Roman occupation of Britain as well, which is, once again, we still uncover things to do with the Romans. So that's 2,000 years ago, Ron. So,
yeah.
You know, and Britain, if you be honest, is a very built-up country in the scheme of things. When you compare it to, like I say, some of the large states, and as you refer to the area you live, is quite remote and, you know, not many people live there. There's probably no community like that in the United Kingdom other than the north end of Scotland. So it's frustrating and it's perplexing because America is so vast. I find it very hard to believe that everything in regards to American archaeology and history, the surface has even been scratched on it, Ron.
I would think so. However, I will say this.
Mm.
The people who came and went across they went across from the East Coast all the way to California, and they went in wagon trains, and they were pioneers. And one of the things that they did is they kept diaries. It's astonishing. You go to a small town, to the old historical museum, and ask them, do they have any of the diaries? And you'll find wives' diaries of someone who was on the plains, who had just crossed 1,200 miles of just nothingness to get to this plot. They were going to, and she had written down everything they saw. And every single thing that they did, and they would write down things like, went by this river, and there were gigantic mounds like pyramids there. Mm. And that's all that's there. So, and backtracking some of that, they did write a lot of it down, but we're finding, and I'll go back to what you were saying, Britain, I'm always watching what's coming out of England and the United Kingdom about finds that are, everybody's saying, what, 500 coins. We've been planting carrots there for 300 years, and someone went down one more inch, and there it was. And it happens all over. I think there's a lot more history that we've forgotten about. Mm. The other thing, where I live, is we're separated from Ontario in Canada by a couple of lakes. And from Wisconsin by an imaginary line. But when you go, and I went and researched some ancient gardens and some ancient burial mounds, and somewhere on the Michigan side, somewhere on the Wisconsin side, but in talking to the Native Americans and going over to Canada to the petroglyphs there, none of those lines existed. Mm. It was a region. It was a northern region. And the only reason our thinking gets messed up is because we keep thinking in the terms of state or parish or national boundary lines that 2,000 years ago didn't exist. So these people were all working together and trading together and intermarrying and trading artifacts from explorers who had gone through there. I mean, the Native Americans, who the Hurons, were dominant over by Nova Scotia. They were in wars all the way over here with the Iroquois and the Ojibwe. So these people were interacting way before Europeans ever got here.
Mm. It is remarkable. Whilst we were thinking, I was thinking, not only did someone find some coins while they were gardening, the city of Norwich, which is in the southeast of the UK, they're currently doing a renovation of the city centre, Ron, in a delightfully named part of the town known as Tombland. whilst they've been doing these alterations, they've uncovered skeletons. This whole area had already been redeveloped, and they miss these skeletons that have been there for hundreds of years. So it just shows you, like you say, all you need to do is maybe go to that, you know, an inch, 2 inches further down. And who knows what you're going to
uncover. You said they called it Tombland?
It is called Tombland, yeah. But that's not the reason it's called Tombland. Tombland, I think, comes from Scandinavian, and it means quiet area, lonely area.
Oh, got it.
So it's ironic that they've been redeveloping this area called Tombland and they found some skeletons. So obviously they've had to stop and call the archaeologists in to remove them. But yeah, that's one of those things. This was a redeveloped area. They've dug a little bit deeper and found something else.
Well, it happens, and it happens all over here in the Upper Peninsula. I haven't published on this yet. I've taken photographs. There's a site not far from where I am where there are three huge stone circles, not like Stonehenge, but big stone circles. They're 100 feet across. And when you stand inside the circle, the walls are above your head. And they're in a north-south line. And if I go talk to the people in the area asking about these, what these are, no one there knows that they're there. They're deep inside a forest that's protected by a biological area. I was told about it years and years ago and finally got someone to guide me to these. But I'll talk to people who are living 5 miles from where these are and they're saying, no, what? And so it only takes one generation to forget our history. Yeah. And in two generations, we've forgotten that Grandpa had this old Viking sword that he kept in the barn.
Yes.
That he'd found while he was plowing the field.
Yeah.
In spring of 1801. I mean, that's how, and then we just forget about it.
Yeah.
I have a whole section I do on the Newbury tablet and the Nagur gods, which were dug up here in 1867 and still exist. And no one has any clue how these objects actually got to the central part of the Upper Peninsula and what they represent. But they were found in the rootstock of a tree that blew over in 1867. And the tree was 150 years old when it blew over. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of that kind of stuff, which is what I go collect. When I hear about this, that kind of stuff, I'll go looking for it and make sure that it actually exists. And if it exists, then we put it into a book and put it on the website.
Fantastic. Well, it's remarkable, Ron, and it's been absolutely fascinating having the opportunity to talk to you about the Macintosh stone and other items. So what's next for you? What have you got planned and what are you working on? Where is your journey going to take you next, my friend?
Well, I've got two things that have cropped up. One is an artifact that was found in the central part of Michigan. I don't think that it's ancient, but it's going to have a great story behind it. The other is this artifact that I mentioned earlier that was found up on the Keweenaw Peninsula, and I'll send you a couple of photographs of it. We're thinking this is really, really ancient, and we've had metallurgical studies done on it, and there's no reason in the world why this object should have been dug up in the forest in the Keweenaw Peninsula. There's no reason why it should have been there unless someone from the north of Africa had been here hundreds of years ago. So it's a very interesting project. Don't have a whole lot yet. Paul, a lot of this stuff takes a long time to dig through. But I don't mind sending you some pictures from time to time saying, hey, look at this. Do you want to talk about this? Because I've got a list of half a dozen places and objects that I need to go look at over the next year. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Fabulous. That sounds fantastic. And I'd always be delighted to be kept up to date with anything you've got planned. Because like I say, once I uncovered your site and had a look at your work and things like that, Ron, it was tantalizingly addictive. It was, what else can I find out? So I would be delighted.
Okay, that's very cool. What do you want?
So, Ron, where can everybody find your work and check your website out, my friend?
Go to www.michiganbackroads.com. That's roads with an S, all one word. Or you can just Google Michigan Backroads. I'll come right up at the top. And I have two or three websites there. Social media. We put out pictures every week. Lots of things going. I have a podcast that tells some of these stories. So, and I always want to hear from people. If you send me an email or call me, I will respond. I always want to hear from people about what they found.
Fantastic. Well, I recommend it, Hannah. Like I say, it's a wonderful site, and it gives you a real taste and flavor of the area. And there are some wonderfully intriguing and strange things to discover in Michigan, Ron. So thank you for bringing them to light. And I mean this most sincerely. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you this evening.
Me too, Paul. Thank you very much. I hope we can do this again.